For years, there's been a lot of excitement about the idea of wind power and solar energy someday replacing dirty energy sources like gas and coal. But how realistic is it that wind and solar could one day be mainstream? So far, they've been held back by their cost and technological limitations. But our next guest believes the alternative energy industry has finally reached a stage where it can solve some of those problems if we can learn the correct lessons from the past 10 years. Jeffrey Ball is a scholar in residence at Stanford University's Steyer Taylor Center for Energy Policy and Finance, and he joins us from Stanford Studios. Before he was at Stanford, he was a longtime energy reporter and environment report editor at the Wall Street Journal. And Jeff, you have described the renewable or sustainable energy industry as a gangly teenager, which is an image we really love. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is that over the past several years, renewable energy technologies have grown up fast. They've grown up in terms of the amount of energy that they provide, and they've gotten more competitive than they were in terms of cost. But if these technologies are going to scale up to a point where they are environmentally meaningful or competitive broadly economically, the world's going to have to get a lot smarter about how to go about scaling them up. They're facing real growing pains right now, like most teenagers do around the world. And it's unclear whether they're going to reach a productive adulthood. But whether they do at scale is going to have a lot to do with how we approach them.
And what do you? What would you say are the top issues that are holding the industry back?
Well, I think the big issue is cost. And there are a lot of points that feed into that. We are in the middle, obviously, of a recession around the world, and that has caused a number of governments to pull back incentives for renewable energy technologies. These are technologies that have grown on the backs of incentives over the past several years. In the United States, we have newly cheap natural gas, which makes for a tougher bar for renewable energy technologies to compete against because effectively wind and solar power produce electricity, as does natural gas. And so if gas is cheaper, wind and solar have to be that much cheaper to be economic. There has been a lot of very torrid growth in these technologies over the past few years, which has led to a real overcapacity. And that is causing huge problems for the companies that make this stuff. The stocks of a lot of these companies have tanked, so they're in trouble. That's a problem. There is a nasty trade fight raging between the United States and China over clean energy. And lastly, there are issues that arise about the bigness of renewable energy. There are a lot of people who don't want large solar farms or large wind farms in their midst. Then you get to questions about when renewable energy gets really big, how do you integrate this stuff into the grid? What does it do to bring in wind and solar? Wind doesn't blow all the time. Sun doesn't shine all the time. What does that mean for a power grid that's predicated on reliable sources like coal and gas?
You've written that a lot of this industry has been driven by government incentives, but that many of those incentives are counterproductive. They result in, for example, a glut of turbines. And you specifically have cited Texas, which has what you call a boom-bust cycle of wind farm development because of the way that tax subsidies work there. What are we doing wrong when it comes to subsidizing this industry, and how do we fix it?
Well, what we're doing wrong is that we are incentivizing not terribly thoughtfully, or have been incentivizing not terribly thoughtfully. I'll give you a couple of examples. In the United States, the early incentives for wind power were incentives not based on how much electricity the turbines produced, but just on how much money investors spent on the turbines. And so predictably, what you got was a lot of turbines that were put up that didn't work very efficiently. And some of them are still standing today. That has changed in the United States to a tax credit that's based on the output of electricity, not just the investment. Because of the way that that tax credit is structured, it turns out that Wall Street banks need to play a big role in monetizing that. And so a big portion of the money that's spent on renewable energy goes to the profit of the bankers who are facilitating the deals. Now, that's capitalism, but that is a question about the efficiency of the system. There are similar problems in China and in Europe. I'll give you an example in China. Similarly, China structured its incentives for wind power. China has become the biggest producer of wind turbines in the world. China has a large swath of the middle of the country where something like 25% of the wind turbines that have been installed are not connected to the grid. That's a function of the kind of policies that were used to incentivize the creation of these turbines, and again, not very efficient.
And Jeff, we're coming up on a break, but I want to ask you a question about energy efficiency, because you've said that we've put all this priority on promoting wind and solar, yet we really need to be making our buildings and our machines more energy efficient, because if we don't, then we're wasting our money. In fact, you point out that before Denmark started pushing for wind energy there, it had a massive and successful drive for energy efficiency. So there are many layers here.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's really important to take the kind of broad view here. People like to talk about renewable energy technologies because they're sexy. People can think about a wind turbine or a solar panel and picture it. But virtually every study that's looked at the economic path toward a broadly cleaner energy system says that energy efficiency ought to be the first step. That is, it doesn't make much sense to slap a solar panel on the roof of a house or put a wind turbine in the middle of a field if the house itself leaks energy. And so you want to think about what to start with.
Exactly. That's Jeffrey Ball. He's a longtime energy reporter and environment editor at The Wall Street Journal. He's now a scholar in residence at Stanford University. And we're talking with him about the shape and the future of the renewable energy industry today and what it needs to go mainstream. We'll be back with him more in about a minute. This is Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about clean energy and whether the wind and solar industries have finally cleared some of the technological and cost hurdles to compete with fossil fuels. Our guest is Jeffrey Ball, a scholar in residence at Stanford and a former reporter and editor for The Wall Street Journal. Jeff, before the break, you mentioned China, and any conversation about solar ends up including a conversation about the competition between U.S. and China. And in fact, cheap solar panels from China often get blamed for killing off American solar panel makers, Solyndra probably being the best known. But you've written that behind the scenes, investors in both of those countries are actually scrambling to make deals with each other. What's going on there?
Yeah, Sasha, it's a really interesting dichotomy. If you read the headlines, you'd think that the relationship between the United States and China over clean energy broadly or renewable energy more specifically is just a trade war. And as you mentioned, there is indeed a trade war going on, fights over allegations that China is illegally, quote-unquote, dumping solar panels onto the U.S. market in violation of international trade rules. And so absolutely that fight is raging, and lots of people feel very strongly about it. What's also interesting, though, is that even as that political fight is raging, there's a really palpable increase in cross-investment, which gets less attention, between investors in the United States and China. So you have Chinese investors investing in American renewable energy companies. You have American renewable energy technologists, people who have invented these things, going over to China to set up shop. Because simply because China has such a voracious demand for energy of all sorts, much more than the United States does, they're finding a market for their technologies in China where they don't in the U.S., and they're also finding a lot more money in terms of investment than they're finding in the U.S. And how this all plays out is very, very unclear. It's causing a lot of consternation against the political backdrop of concern about who ought to be investing in whom. But it's a really, really interesting story in terms of how this broad clean energy industry globalizes, which I think is key to understanding the future of it.
When we look around the world at the push for using alternative energies, you've pointed out that historically it's some kind of crisis like the oil embargo in the 1970s that pushes a country to shift away from fossil fuels. Give us maybe an example or two of what some other countries have done or what they're doing that we can learn from.
Yeah, I think it's really important to understand this context. I think it is absolutely the case that historically when places have made big energy shifts, and several have, they've done it not for anything as esoteric as the notion of creeping climate change. What they've done it because of is a palpable sort of immediate shock to the energy system. So, for instance, In 1973, there was an Arab oil embargo, which caused ultimately massive change in the energy systems of a number of countries that didn't have a lot of domestic fossil fuels. France is a very good example. France now gets about 80% of its electricity from nuclear energy. It was not always the case, and it moved to nuclear because it decided that it had no choice but to get off oil, which at the time was being used to produce a lot of electricity. Denmark, you mentioned Denmark earlier. Denmark shifted in a big way to energy efficiency and then ultimately to wind, largely because of a shock to the supply of its fossil fuel. I think that's what's going on in China right now. China feels a palpable crisis. For any of your listeners who have landed in China, you can smell the pollution. That's a public health threat, and it's also a political threat to the rulers in China, and they realize that.
Right, smell it, see it. Many stories
exactly.
Lately about how terrible those levels have gotten.
Indeed, there was something that's been called the airpocalypse in Beijing over the past week or two. I guess the last thing I'd say on this is I think it's really important to understand that we in the United States do not feel a crisis in the palpable way that these other countries have or in the case of China do. Whatever one thinks about the long-term threat of climate change, and people disagree about it, the reality is that polling shows that most Americans don't feel it viscerally like they feel smog or like they feel gasoline prices surging when there's a supply shock. And so I think that's what that's important to understanding the difficulty of a shift in the United States, at least toward some of these technologies. Mm.
Sometimes you have to smell it or inhale it until you realize the sense of urgency. You
know, yeah,
Jeff, in your writing, you've been very tough on the United States' approach to pushing renewable power. You've said it's been sloppy, it's been schizophrenic. These are your words. But you also say it doesn't mean we should ditch the idea of pursuing alternative energy sources. We just have to be smart. Could you give us one or two specifics on what do we need to do to be smarter?
Yeah, let me just say, just as a lead up to that, that I don't think it's just the United States that's been sloppy. I think broadly, if you look at the effort to scale up renewable energy around the world, even in Europe, in Asia, it's also been sloppy. And by sloppy, let me just be clear that what I mean is not that the effort has been misguided, but that the effort hasn't generated the bang for the buck that it might have. It hasn't been as economically efficient as it might have. And going forward, I think for a lot of the reasons we talked about, there's going to be less government support for these sorts of things, and therefore people who want to scale these things up are going to have to be much more cognizant of the need for economic efficiency in doing it. And so you asked for an example or two. I'll give you one or two. One is to realize against the backdrop of discussions of things like this trade fight between the United States and China that the renewable energy industry, like most industries, is a global industry, becoming more so by the day. And so policies that seek to sort of protect domestic industries simply to protect domestic jobs may succeed in protecting domestic jobs, but they may not succeed in making renewable energy globally as cheap as it otherwise might be. So one has to be clear on what one's goals are. The other is that the subsidies themselves haven't been structured in a terribly efficient way, and there are other ways to do that.
That's Jeffrey Ball. He's a longtime energy reporter and environment editor at the Wall Street Journal, and he's now a scholar in residence at Stanford University's Steyer Taylor Center for Energy Policy and Finance. Jeff, thanks very much for talking with us about this.
Nice to be with you. Thanks.
Next week on Here and Now, did you know that the government doesn't consider energy drinks to be drinks? They're classified as dietary supplements, and that's why they can have unlimited amounts of caffeine. But medical experts say they need to be regulated due to a spike in energy drink-related emergency room visits. That's coming up on Monday. News is next, Here and Now.